Today is January 29th, 2014. This is episode number 240 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, pastry chef. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you would like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com. And if you would like to send us pastries, please do.
My request, dairy-free, please.
That would be a good thing for all concerned.
Oh, boy, howdy. So, pastry chef.
I wish we had a real pastry chef. Because, you know, I'm not very good at it.
Well, you know, I remember when we first started hunting for interns, and by hunting, I mean when we grabbed the people and duct taped them and threw them in the trunk of the car. It's okay, people. It's a company car.
Yeah, it's fine.
We just assumed they'd be able to make quality pastries.
We got a license from the Koch brothers for that.
Yeah, and I haven't seen good pastries.
No, none.
Not so far. One.
Yeah, you. Yeah, I'm talking about that mess you made.
Yeah, burnt Pop-Tarts, not a pastry. Yeah,
exactly. But, well, to be fair, Pop-Tarts, not a pastry.
That's true. Although,
and I like Pop-Tarts, I'm going to be honest.
I just recently found out that many Pop-Tarts are dairy-free.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That makes sense, since they're probably largely food-free, too.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah, and that's this week's This Week in Pastry.
Exactly.
Thanks for listening, and oh, yeah.
All right, that's just ridiculous. We have some things. We have some real stuff to talk about.
I guess we do.
Let's start off with this last week in between the last show and this one. The Mac had a birthday.
It did. 30 years old. That's cool on a couple levels. First, because that 30 years. And then second, because I don't know of any other computer line that has lasted 30 years.
It's true.
And we went from an all-in-one Mac back to an all-in-one Mac.
It's also true. It is also true.
Yeah. And I think it's really cool that there was a whole celebration event in San Francisco on the day the Macintosh was introduced, and it was held at the same venue where the Macintosh was introduced.
Yeah, still in San Jose, though. Actually, Cupertino. You keep wanting to throw us in San Francisco there.
But you're right. It wasn't actually in San Francisco. I forgot the name of the venue. It starts with an F. Is that right?
Yeah, the Flint Center at the Anza College. As you said, same place where it was introduced. This event wasn't held by Apple. It was put together by Gabriel Franklin, a filmmaker, mm-hmm. and Daniel Kottke, one of Apple's first employees.
Yes, and they got together as many people as they could from the original Mac design team.
Yep, including engineers and designers, they let the the Macworld All-Star Band, which is a band that I'm a part of, and Dave Hamilton's a part of, and Chris Breen and Bob Levitis and Paul Kent and Dwayne Straub and Chuck LaTornis. Then we usually play Cirque du Mac, TMO's party,
TMO and Backbeat. You always play Cirque du Mac.
That's true. We do, in fact, always play Cirque du Mac. And that's our party that we throw during Macworld iWorld in San Francisco. This time it's actually in San Francisco. And they let us be a part of this event, which was just fantastic because, seeing all these legends... These Apple legends gathered and together and telling stories, and just looking back at their own early days, working and you know, giving life to the Mac. It was incredible.
It looked like an amazing event, and it's so cool. They set up the panels so that everyone that was there could get insight into what was happening during the design process from the people that were actually making the Macintosh happen. And I think it was just really cool that they chose to open the event with the band, because it's always fun, and the band is great. And the band is made up of people that have been deeply involved in the Macintosh community for a very long time. So I think that was just a really nice special touch.
Obviously not as long as the panel members. I mean, you know,
right.
To be fair, if you were looking, you know, if you put us all up on the stage, someone would probably start humming "One of These Things Just Doesn't Belong There." And they'd be talking about us. But the legends that were there, you know, and as time goes on, opportunities to do this sort of thing will by definition become fewer and fewer.
That's true, because the people involved in any project like this, over time, there will be fewer and fewer of them left to be able to attend events for whatever reason.
Working 90 hours a week, probably not doing a lot of good for your longevity either.
Probably not.
Although, and, you know, being a millionaire later, maybe that helps.
I'm sure it takes away some of the sting.
It does probably take care of some of this. But, you know, we had Andy Hertzfeld. We had Steve Capps, whom I admire quite a lot. We had Bill Atkinson, who is just a genius. And, you know, it's funny. Everyone that was watching this thing ended up coming back to his postcards app.
Oh, fun.
Right, that's his. Do you know that app?
No.
Take a picture somewhere, and then using his app, it's called Postcards, it's either Postcard or Postcards, and he prints up a postcard, and he actually does this himself. Prints up a postcard, fills it out, and mails it for you.
Oh, I've heard of this.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's Bill Atkinson. This is the guy that essentially invented Quick Draw. You know? I mean, like who made it possible for the Mac to be the Mac. He's one of the people that made it possible for the Mac to be the Mac. And by the way, Bob Levitas told me a hilarious little tidbit. He says that he likes to send postcards to Bill Atkinson and his wife through the postcard app when he travels.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think that's hilarious. But Caroline Rose was there. She's the one who wrote all the documentation for the original Mac. Bill Fernandez was there. He was actually emceeing the event. Bruce Horn, the guy who wrote the Finder, he was there. And other people too. I mean, there were just so many people, so many legends, and they told great stories. You know, some of them we've heard before, but some of them we haven't. And like one of the things that I wasn't particularly familiar with was Caroline Rose was talking about. Well, first Andy Hertzfeld explained how the price of the Mac evolved when it was Jeff Raskin's project. It was going to be a $995 appliance. You know, what Jeff Raskin's originally envisioned as the Macintosh is not what Steve Jobs ended up creating and shipping. And it went from $995 to $1,495 as they started adding features and capabilities, and they added they moved to the Motorola 68K processor, which was expensive, and then it went to $1,995, and then. John Sculley decided that they needed to pay for a big advertising campaign, and so the price was made $24.95. And the point that I had heard all that before, but the point that I hadn't heard was Caroline Rose talking about how everybody was just heartbroken. She used that phrase when they went to that price, because they knew that bumping it over $2,000. Really limited the notion of it being the computer for the rest of us from a financial standpoint.
Sure.
And
especially in 1984.
Yeah, exactly. These are $1984 dollars. And that's what they had been working on. That's what they had given so much of their of themselves to, is creating this computer for the rest of us. And now it wasn't going to be for the rest of us. It was going to be initially businesses could probably afford it. And so, like, everybody, she said, was really heartbroken. And, you know, certainly there were lots of stories about Steve. I don't think I mentioned this to you, Jeff. We saw extended clips from a presentation by Randy Wigginton was there too, by the way. But we saw this this presentation that Steve Jobs gave to the Boston Computer Society.
Oh, wow!
In 1984, and Randy Wigginton was up on stage with him. Bill Atkinson was up on stage. Bruce Horn might have been there too. There were basically many of the team members that were there with Steve, and Steve, you know, would sort of, he answered some of the questions, and then he had the guys and women give actually I think it was all guys give demonstrations of some of the various things that the Mac could do, because, you know, this was a brand new concept at the time.
Yeah, people had no basis for comparison. So until you showed them what it could do, they had no way of actually conceptualizing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I had, supposedly this has never been seen before. It was a first, or at least it hadn't been, you know, seen probably in the last 30 years. And I certainly had never seen it, and it was absolutely fascinating to be able to see parts of that. And I hope that if this event ends up being released on DVD, which it's supposed to be, that they're able to include all of that, or at least the parts that they showed us.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it was cool. It was a really cool night, man.
I'm so glad you got to be a part of that, because that's truly a once in a lifetime experience.
Yeah. You know, could there be a, you know, something similar for the 40th anniversary?
There could be, but this was truly a first, because when the 25th anniversary came around, Steve Jobs didn't do anything.
No, because he doesn't like looking back.
Right, and there's a difference between looking back and honoring the legacy of the Macintosh.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and that's what it's one of the interesting things to me for this week was that Apple actually paid tribute to the Mac for 30 years. You know, the 30th birthday.
Yes, they changed the homepage at apple.com.
Yep. Then
they added in the mini site just for the Mac tribute, where they had videos,
the timeline,
and then the little poll where you could say what your first Mac was and how you used it.
I couldn't. My first Mac was a power computing device.
And
none of the clones were
none
represented.
Of the clones were there.
And I actually think that Apple should have included the clones, because while cloning was a mistake, and Steve was right to shut it down, it's still a part of our legacy as Mac users.
I agree. So your first Mac was Power Computing?
Yep, Power 100.
So that was a was that the 68040? That was actually a PowerPC processor.
Yeah, it was a PowerPC product. That's why they were called Power Computing.
That's right. It's been so long, it's hard for me to remember.
It was a 601.
Yeah. So it was probably the 601 processor.
Yeah, 100 megahertz 601.
Yeah.
Device, and I forget which particular Mac it was based on, but all their motherboards were based on Apple motherboards. That's how the deal worked. But anyway, nonetheless, they didn't include any of that on the timeline. But they released that tribute video where people talked about the impact that the Macintosh had on themselves or their industry or their art. Most of the people were actually in creative professions,
mm-hmm. Which makes sense.
And that was really cool. And another thing they did was, and I haven't seen it live. I don't know if this is one of the things they have at the Apple Store. But there's that 30? Rainbow-colored 30?
Yes.
Have you seen that? Those are the signatures of all the Apple employees. They're, like, squished in there.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
wow.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to actually see that. I would actually love to have a poster of that because I think it's just super cool.
That's very cool. Yeah, I swung by the Boulder Apple store that evening so that I could see the window displays in the dark. And it was really neat to see the 30 where the zero is the Apple logo. And the Apple stores right now, they have the LED grids that are, or mesh grids that are hanging.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was going through rainbow colors and it just looked really nice. I thought it was a very classy tribute to the Mac. And when you went in the stores, all the employees were wearing black t-shirts with the 30
nice.
on the chest.
Oh man.
It was really slick.
I would really like to have one of those. If anyone out there is listening who could make that happen, it needs to be rather large because I'm rather large.
And I would love to get a hold of one too. I'm a medium.
Yeah. But you know, back to, I want to actually dig a little bit into to something we alluded to a few minutes ago. Steve Jobs did not like looking back, but the reality is that the Macs, and I understand. So I don't even know what I'm trying to say here. I understand why he doesn't like looking back, and I understand that not looking back is part of what made him so effective as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But to those of us out here who use these devices, to those of us for whom the Mac has been, either an important part of our professional or creative or even personal lives, Nancy Carroll Gravely has written many stories about how the Mac has been liberating for someone, you know, who's actually made it possible for someone with some mental disabilities to become a productive member of society. It was a fantastic story. Anyway, for us, for we the people, we the Mac users, for the rest of us, paying tribute and honoring the legacy of the Mac is a legitimate and important thing, and that's something that I don't think that Steve. I don't think Steve had time to understand that sort of thing.
I think you're right. That was outside the scope of his reality. And he was always just moving forward, and whatever was left behind was simply left behind.
Yeah. Yeah, he's always, you know, he was wasn't interested in what kind of great thing you created 2 weeks ago. He's interested in what's the next great thing you're going to create for him.
And that's part of what made him so good at what he did. That said, I'm glad that Tim Cook sees the value in recognizing what the Macintosh has been to so many people for so many years.
Yes. Plus, it is quite likely that doing so can have a positive impact on Apple's Mac sales.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that.
Right. And it also made for a nice platform for moving forward as well. Because part of what came out of the whole celebration was beyond the whole this is where we came from, but was looking forward to where they're headed. And so we got little tidbits like Apple's excited to see what happens with the Mac over the next 30 years, mm-hmm. which is a nice way of saying the Mac is still a long-term project for Apple.
Right.
And there was talk about the future of the Mac operating system, and they made it very clear that OS X and iOS are not going to converge.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I'll believe that when I don't see it, but yeah.
Well, okay. So based on what they said, my interpretation is we will see features creep back and forth between the operating systems.
Yeah.
But that Apple understands that the Microsoft way of one operating system to rule them all is not a good business plan. And so they will make sure that the elements that need to be unique for the different platforms are.
Right. That's, you know, fair enough. And that's a very good point. By the way, if in case you're hearing any noise on my end, it's because the mouse I've been using for the last 5 years, the USB dongle fried on me. And I've been using this mouse. I have other mice packed away somewhere, but I cannot find them and don't know where they are. And so I've got my MacBook Air in front of me, screen sharing into my MacBook Pro to record this, and the added processing power from the screen sharing appears to be kicking my fans on.
Aha! Uh-huh.
So I apologize, but it's kind of quite ridiculous here with this little setup I've got right now.
So, what's your pointing device of choice?
It is the Logitech MX Revolution mouse.
Isn't it interesting how we're both kind of old school on our favorite pointing device? Because you're using the Logitech Revolution MX, and I'm using the Kensington Orbit trackball.
The trackball, yeah. Well, I do still play games, and I don't like... I like trackpads, and I like... what Apple's done with trackpads is amazing. But when it comes to things like gaming, trackpads are not a great choice. And this Logitech MX Revolution mouse, which is no longer sold, has this weighted square wheel that'll free. It's so incredibly ergonomic. It's a great mouse.
You know, if anyone knows where any of these are stashed away with a working wireless dongle, you know where to find Brian.
Yeah, let me know. I'll pay. I will pay. I'm definitely would love to get some just the dongles, because I've got two of the mice that I've been hoarding. I have a third one on the way. I'm going to be honest. I have a third one that I ordered on eBay, but finding the dongles by themselves are kind of difficult. So
it is very frustrating when your dongle doesn't work,
but it's just the one time.
Right.
This has never happened before.
Right.
That's never happened before.
That's lucky.
Yeah. So let's move on and talk a little bit about the, we're talking about Google selling its Motorola Mobility business to Chinese firm Lenovo for a whopping $2.91 billion.
Yes, all of this came out today before we started recording.
It actually delayed our recording.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Lenovo will be getting basically the hardware division that was Motorola Mobility. And Google has already spun off pretty much everything else. So after the $2.91 billion changes hands, Google will be left with a stack of patents for Motorola Mobility, which so far hasn't proven to be all that valuable to them.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're they spun off the cable box business for just under $2.5 billion, like in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
They paid $12.5 billion for Motorola originally, so if you count the $2.91 billion that they're getting from Lenovo, that puts the cost of the loss for this whole Motorola thing at right about $8 billion, actually a little bit more. But, you know, I guess we could knock off the $1.7 million that they got from Motorola, you know, kind of turn that into a more manageable $7.9983 billion that this thing has cost them.
To be fair, you need to knock off another $75 million. There is another component that Google sold off that I can't remember what it was now, but I remember it was 75 million.
Yes. All right. So that would be 7.9908 billion. Whatever. The point is they've lost a lot of money on this. And yes, they're supposedly keeping, quote unquote, most of the patents. Although the number I saw, one of the whisper numbers that I saw was that it was that Lenovo was going to get 10,000 patents.
And Google isn't saying officially. The word from Larry Page's statement is that Google is keeping the majority of the patents. So no actual number offered up, and he did say that they're holding on to them so that they can use them in their defense of Android intellectual property.
Yeah, and as you said, so far that's been a really winning strategy where they've pretty much won nothing, and where no one has won nothing.
Right, and many of the patents that Motorola Mobility, before being purchased by Google, had been pushing as part of their patent infringement litigation were standards essential, or considered right. standards essential. And so the FTC has ordered, and I believe this was maybe about a year ago, but anyhow, the FTC ordered Motorola Mobility to start licensing those standard essential patents, regardless of whether or not they really wanted to. So a big stack of those patents that Google bought, they're not in a position to be able to use them as aggressively as they would have liked.
Right. Yeah, and the whole, I mean, here's why I gave my best Nelson Muntz. Actually, that wasn't my best. Let me try another one. That still wasn't my best. Nonetheless, the reason why I'm giving a Nelson Muntz there is because when Google bought Motorola, it was hailed by all the Apple haters as a genius move. And it was a genius purchase for Google. And it was just, you know, like, oh my God, they think out of the box, and they're buying this company. They're going to get all these patents, and they're going to be able to fight. It's going to level the playing field with our with Apple on the patent front. And you know, and this is just evidence of how awesome Google is and how smart Larry Page is.
You know, where I saw this as a potentially brilliant move for Google, and it wasn't for the leveling the patent playing field and all that, it was because it gave Google the opportunity to do what Apple does and create the whole widget.
Yes.
And
that was the thing that excited me about it.
Yeah, I was actually really excited about what sort of devices, what sort of smartphones could come out of Motorola Mobility with Google at the helm, because now they have a direct tie right into the most current version of Android, like so current, so up to date that it's not even available publicly yet. So they can build for the operating system. And
that's not what happened. That's not what Google did. Google instead bent over backwards to pretend like they didn't own Motorola.
Which is unfortunate, because they had such an opportunity there. And to be fair, Motorola, they released a couple phones that were actually, in the last year, had potential to be really good. It was like the G, and I can't remember what the other one was. Those phones showed that Motorola had the ability to seriously compete in the smartphone game, and that's all gone now.
Well, it's possible that Lenovo is going to be able to do more with this, but back to let me finish up the original point before we talk about what Lenovo might actually do, and that was that this was hailed as proof of Google's genius, and the end result is, you know, 2.5 years later, you know, basically Google has managed to to lose $1 billion of valuation for what it paid $12.5 billion for per quarter since they've owned Motorola.
That's got to hurt.
Yeah, you know, $7 billion in actual purchase losses, and then they've lost another $1 billion or so in operating losses through Motorola.
Yeah, and so, then what have they lost in other related expenses, like legal expenses related to patent litigation?
Yeah, and you know, and time that Larry Page and other top Google execs have spent fiddling with Motorola. I mean, it's just the whole thing has been an unmitigated disaster. They have lost billions of dollars in this genius move, and even now, even today, people are bending over backwards to talk about how fantastic this is going to be for Android. And like all these people working overtime pretending that this Motorola fiasco has been anything other than a fiasco for Google. And it has been an unmitigated disaster. It is a debacle. It is a clown show. And if Apple had done this, of course, note that Apple would not have done this. But if Apple had done this, it would be everyone would be working overtime instead to talk about how it's proof of Apple's inevitable demise. That, you know, that they weren't able to make an acquisition like this is such a obvious, you know, no-brainer acquisition like this work. They couldn't do it, and this is proof that there's no leadership or vision within the company. I cannot believe the way Google is being treated by the press, even as you and I are recording this.
It's absolutely fascinating, and contrast that with Apple having multiple quarters of really strong iPhone sales, year over year numbers are up, and yet the media and analysts look at all of this and they're like, oh my God, Apple is doomed.
So, well, we should probably talk about Apple's quarterly announcements next.
Yes, I'm getting ahead of us. Foreshadowing, people.
Foreshadowing. Yeah, so you know, let's actually look at Lenovo. Here's a Chinese company that basically buys what it can't create. They don't get me wrong, they have done a fantastic job of turning what IBM was hating, which was its consumer PC business, mm-hmm. into a thriving global consumer PC brand. Lenovo has done a fantastic job of that.
Yes, ThinkPad is a very popular PC brand.
Yep. And Lenovo is now one of the largest, if not the largest, I forget who's number one right now, but they're certainly one of the largest PC makers on the planet at this point. It is possible that they're going to be able to turn this Motorola acquisition into a successful Android OEM business. It's very possible. Personally doubt it. I think they're going to be yet another OEM, and they'll take some share away from Samsung at best.
It's hard to say, because if you look at what they did with IBM's PC line, they were essentially another OEM in the market, but they've done very well. So they've set the precedent that they have the ability with the right pieces to be able to stand out in a market where otherwise they're just another guy. So there's that. But the big benefit that Motorola had, well, or still has up until the point where the sale is final, is that they have that direct link back into Google. And once the deal is done, Lenovo's not going to have that level of access.
No, especially, you know, keep in mind that Google and Samsung just recently announced a a patent cross-licensing deal. So, you know, it seems like Google is wanting to get in bed a little bit better with Samsung.
Yeah. So
not Lenovo.
Yeah. So the way I see that is that Google is getting all chummy with Samsung, and they're taking their own smartphone hardware business and throwing it under the bus.
Yeah. And I'll be surprised if so Motorola Mobility has, despite their stumbles, there's a lot of talent and a rich history of killer mobile devices. And yes, I will be surprised if Lenovo can actually keep all those folks. And I'll be interested to, I'll be surprised if, from a culture standpoint, if they're able to successfully integrate Motorola into their business. I mean, you know, by and large, when they bought IBM's business, they took the technology and went back to China with it.
Right. So expecting them to buy Motorola Mobility and say, okay, guys, just keep up the good work, and walk away, that's not reasonable. I would expect them to do with Motorola Mobility what they did with IBM, which is take it back to China.
Yeah, and I'm not really sure what they're taking back, if that's going to end up being the case. So, I mean, you know, because a lot of what Motorola has to offer is, in fact, you know, it's the patents and it's the people. And you know, and it's facilities too. You know, they may be interested in doing more design work here in the States. I mean, that's certainly possible. They might have every intention in the world of doing everything they can to maintain the Motorola team, and then, you know, just bring their own manufacturing expertise to bear. You know, we don't know what they're doing, and I don't want to dismiss Lenovo's ability to do all this stuff. I just think this is going to end up not mattering in the long run. I guess that's what I want to say.
Yeah, I think it has more potential for success than Microsoft buying Nokia's cell phone business. But I think that...
Oh, yeah. Orders of magnitude more.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I think that the potential for a failure is still pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Really is. Really, really, really is. So you mentioned it. So let's talk about Apple's earnings announcement and Wall Street's sell-off.
Boy, was that a sell-off. Okay, so on Monday, Apple held their first fiscal quarter earnings report, where they said that they sold 51 million iPhones, 26 million iPads, 4.8 million Macs, and those numbers are up year over year, which is great. But the iPhone numbers fell a couple million or a few million, depending on which analyst you're referring to. It fell below analyst expectations.
Correct.
And just so you know, I pulled all those numbers out of memory.
That's very, very, very impressive. I'm actually looking to see what Apple did today. It lost another $5, another 1%. So closed at $575. And there's a good reason for that. So Apple did turn in a record quarter. And Apple turned in a record quarter, but turned in relatively flat earnings, although earnings per share are way up because they bought back so many shares in the last year.
Yeah, I believe their profit was $13.1 billion.
Yes.
And revenue was $56 billion. 50-something billion?
56 billion, I think it was.
I was doing good all the way up to that point.
And earnings per share were $14.50. Wall Street was only expecting $14.09. Last year's earnings per share, I think, worth like $13.10. But like I said, Apple's bought back so many shares, which is one of the reasons why you do share buybacks, that earnings per share were up. The reason why, and what happened is the stock sold off. It sold off $44 the next day. It sold off in after hours trading. And then Tuesday's action was actually pretty much right at where the after hours was, which is kind of interesting because normally there's an exaggerated, the after hours traded is exaggerated. But my belabored point is that sell-off was based on two things. Apple offered guidance for the March quarter that was essentially flat year over year. And this, so that means that Apple's not growing. Now, stock prices are not based so much on what you did, but what you're going to do. It's almost like, it's like the, you know, stock market is kind of like the financial Steve Jobs. What are you going to do for me tomorrow? And for Apple to not be growing is never going to help the stock.
Now, this quarter, that's a bigger issue, right?
Correct. Absolutely. Because Apple just added China Mobile and Docomo in Japan. And China, you know, China Mobile has been the you know, the holy grail of iPhone carriers for years now. You know, like, when, you know, it's always, when the heck is Apple going to add China Mobile? Well, they finally did it. China Mobile started selling iPhones this month in January, and yet Apple is guiding flat.
So the implication is, even with the expected growth in China, sales have to be tapering off somewhere else to keep it flat.
Yeah, exactly. And that is a real issue now. And it doesn't address the fact that Wall Street has largely discounted Apple. Apple's multiplier is something like 13, and that doesn't even count the mountain of cash that Apple has on hand. And, you know, other companies sell for higher multiples. You know, Amazon's multiple is something like an infinite because they don't actually make any money. Google's multiplier is, I think, closer to 20. This doesn't address that. But when you look at the fact, look at the reality that Wall Street was valuing Apple at a price, and that price was looking for growth, and that price was looking for higher iPhone sales this last quarter. When Apple fails to hit both of those points, if Apple's not going to grow, and if Apple actually missed what Wall Street wanted Apple to sell for iPhones, it makes sense that Wall Street then sells off.
Sure. This
is something a lot of Apple fans don't understand. They say that Apple turned in a record quarter, so therefore the price should go up, and that's not the way it works.
Yeah, there are two things that are two different numbers that you have here. Apple's expected goals, which come from the analysts, and the numbers that Apple is generating themselves. So they can offer their guidance for what they think they're going to do in the following quarter or in the coming quarter. And analysts are going to create their models for what that quarter will look like based on that and several other factors. So just because Apple sells more iPhones than they did the last quarter, or they sell more year over year, so they're showing growth, that's not the same thing as meeting the expectations of the analysts. And in many cases, those expectations are ridiculous. But that's where the valuation for the company is coming from, to a degree.
Right. And again, a lot of Apple fans don't seem to understand this. I mean, you know, the stock market is definitely a complicated thing. But think of it this way. Wall Street says, okay, we think you're going to do $1,000 worth of business next quarter. So because you're going to do $1,000 worth of business, we're going to pay $10 for your stock. When boy, I should complicate my analogy here. So a company does $1,000. There we go. All right. So a company does $1,000 one year in a quarter. And as that year anniversary comes along, Wall Street is expecting that company to do $1 million. And so they say, because you're going to do $1 million, we're going to pay $10 for your stock. When the company turns around and turns in $800,000 instead of $1 million, the fact that it beat the $1,000 from last year is irrelevant. When Wall Street has already said, we're going to give you $10 because you'll do $1 million. If you don't do $1 million, you're going to end up being punished, probably in this case by 20%. You know, the $1 million to $800,000 in my fictitious world here. And this is why Apple's stock sold off, and it makes sense that it did.
Sure. And add to that the fact that so much of what goes on with all of this is emotional, both from the investor standpoint and then just the people that really like Apple. You get the confusion about why isn't the stock rising, and how stupid can people be to be selling it off, and don't these people realize what it's going to be worth? And it's
exactly. And on top of that, remember, as we've discussed before, no one understands what Apple does. I mean, there's this flood of nonsense out there about how Apple is missing this huge opportunity to have market share, as if market share in and of itself is some sort of desirable goal. I'm talking about in the iPhone business, in the smartphone business. And, people don't understand Apple. No one understands Apple. Well, you and I understand Apple. There's a couple of people that understand Apple.
Right, but by and large, the analysts do not.
Correct. The analysts don't. Investors don't. Someone like David Einhorn, I think he does. Oh, Carl Icahn doesn't.
Neither does Donald Trump.
Neither does Donald Trump. I mean, Carl Icahn does understand that Apple offers a tremendous value, and he also understands that Apple is discounted, and I got to give him a lot of credit for that. But oh my goodness, did you read through his letter, right?
Yes, and the comment that I had for at least part of his letter, we actually can't say on this show.
That's true, because we have a family friendly rating there,
and we want to keep that.
So, you know, Carl Icahn has been campaigning for Apple to buy more of its stock back faster. He says that Apple's got a ton of money, which Apple does, $130-140 billion, something like that. And he wants Apple to spend more of that money buying back shares because the company is undervalued, which, from a logical standpoint, makes absolute sense, all things being equal. If a company is undervalued, the company should in fact buy some of the shares back so that its earnings per share go up.
Right, and for Carl Icahn, he has a very personal interest in seeing that happen, because he's been buying up truckloads of Apple stock, and if Apple initiates a more aggressive buyback program, it increases the value of his investment faster.
Yes. Yeah, he's got something like $5.5 billion worth of Apple stock at this point. He plunked down another $1.5 billion just in the last week or so.
Yeah, I understand he's approaching 1% ownership of Apple stock.
At this point, he is one of the largest, if not the largest, Apple shareholder. Certainly as an individual, although his like Carl Icahn Incorporated, whatever the name of his corporate infrastructure is, actually owns all the stock, but whatever.
Right. And lucky for Apple, Carl Icahn knows exactly what needs to be done to really juice up Apple's product line.
Yeah. It's interesting. Carl Icahn heaps praise on Apple. talks about what a great value Apple is, and how undervalued Apple is, and how, you know, the Apple ecosystem is rich beyond belief. Apple's customer loyalty is amazing beyond belief, and you know, Apple is doing all these things right, but Apple's management are comprised of idiots because they won't buy back stock at the rate that Carl Icahn thinks that they should.
So apparently Apple is comprised of lucky idiots.
It must be. It seems to me that he has a little bit of a disconnect. It doesn't occur to him that Apple has a plan for its money.
No, because it's not the plan he wants.
It's not the plan he wants, right? And it would certainly benefit, as you said, it would benefit Carl Icahn if Apple did what Carl Icahn wanted, which is kind of, you know, that's Carl Icahn in a nutshell.
Yes.
And anyway, so he wrote this letter to shareholders that he filed with the SEC, urging them to vote for his shareholder proposal that would require Apple to spend more money buying back more shares.
You say letter, I say tome.
It was 3,000 words. 2,988 words.
It was practically a treatise.
It was rambling. It was rambling. And you know, dude, like, you know, use a paragraph break, man. But the part that was, he makes this compelling argument for how awesome it is in a rambling kind of way, and then he takes two long paragraphs to sort of, I don't know, speculate. How do you even characterize that?
What I would characterize it as a full on fantasy with numbers and figures that he's fabricated out of his nether regions about what products Apple should make, what those products will cost, what they will do, and how much money Apple will make from them.
Yeah, which is. There is a reason why Carl Icahn, there's apparently a reason why Carl Icahn is not known as a product visionary.
Wait, he's not? I mean, after reading his diatribe, I was certain he must be the person everyone goes to decide what tech gear to make next.
Yeah. If you want to read it for yourself, we've got links. Links in the show notes.
Right.
Fun stuff. And, oh, speaking of clowns.
Donald Trump.
Yeah, what did he do?
Oh, man. Okay. So he took to Twitter to rant about about Apple's stock dropping in value after the earnings report. And this happens every earnings report. Apple's stock goes down. And of course it does, because there's so many factors that are coming to play, including emotion, and so their stock drops. So what he said on Twitter was that he predicted Apple's stock was going to take a big hit, and that it's because Apple doesn't make a bigger screen iPhone, and they have to make this happen right away. They need to follow Samsung's lead and get right on that bigger iPhone, and that they're refusing to give this product to their customers. He sold all his Apple stock.
Well, you know, leave aside the fact that Tim Cook has said that Apple will do a larger iPhone when it doesn't have to compromise on the screen quality. You know, leave that aside. Yeah, it was, you know, that man is a buffoon, and his opinions on Apple's product strategy, to me, is every bit as valid as his political opinions. And as I mentioned, the man is a buffoon.
Yes, and he came across as such in his tweets, I think.
He comes across as a buffoon in almost everything he says and does. When he opens his mouth, he comes across as a buffoon. And I'm not just saying this because I'm wanting to defend Apple here. This is just one of those rare instances where my opinions of someone are simply backed up by their opinions of Apple.
You know, when Donald Trump opens his mouth to speak, regardless of the topic, his lips move and all I hear is herp, derp. So one thing that I just loved about his tweets saying he sold off all his Apple stock and that Apple is dumb, and he actually used the word dumb.
He used the word dumb.
Is that Carl Icahn says that investing in Apple stock is a no-brainer.
Which apparently means Donald Trump has no brain.
There you go.
Proof is in the pudding. Yeah. From Carl Icahn's lips to God's ears or something
like that. Something like that.
Hey, listen, you know, we're almost out of time, but I want to mention one little thing before we go, because we're running out of time here. Who makes that product? It's called Dice. We just got this, right? Both Jeff and yes. I just got this in the mail.
I just grabbed the box. It happened to be close. It's called Dice Plus.
Yeah, who's the company?
And hold on. It's got to be on here somewhere. It says Dice all over this box. Dice Plus, play together. Really?
Powered Board Games is the name of the app.
Maybe the product and the company name are the same.
I am guessing that's the case. Yeah, I think the company actually is called Dice. Well, you know what would have been really clever if we'd looked this up ahead of time?
That's just crazy talk, Brian.
I know. Anyway,
Game Technologies. I found it. It's
sweet.
Buried on the spine of the box. Game Technologies.
So what they've made is a die. It's one of them. So, you know, it's die, not dice, but you know, whatever. Let's just leave that aside. And it's a I don't know, what's it about, like 3/4 of an inch on the side?
Sure.
Thereabouts. And it's a die, and it has numbers that light up, and you roll it, and it actually communicates with their app, Powered Board Games. Powered Board Games is the name of the app. And they've got these board games that you can play on your iPad. And when it comes to moving, you roll this physical die, and it communicates with the app. And I just love that, because it's just this physically interactive thing that people, you know, people could sit around and play a board game around an iPad. And when Apple ends up releasing larger iPads, it'd be even more fun. Mm-hmm. And you know, people can physically roll this die and get their results and I just think it's really cool. Now, I played one game. What did you do?
I played one game. I played the game where you're an alien and you're racing against other aliens to.
Oh, I played the same thing.
Yeah,
that's so funny.
To get the farm animals.
To get the farm. Yeah. That's funny that we both. Anyway, this is relatively new, but there are tons of games built into the app already, and you can get more. And you know, some of them are kids games, and some of them, I know there was a war, there's like some kind of World War II flight game, combat game of some sort. So, you know, there's some that are aimed more at adults.
Can I abduct farm animals in that game?
No, I don't.
Then it doesn't matter.
But I love board games, and I think that board games are a great way for people to spend time together and have fun, and to be able to actually do this on your iPad with a physical die that you actually roll and it communicates with you. I just think it's cool. It's fun.
It is cool, and I like how it takes your iPad out of the single user game experience and turns it into a group experience.
Yeah, two, three, four people can sit around an iPad with the table, and you know, hoot and holler and have a good time, and you know, roll this die, and they're all participating in the same thing. I mean, don't get me wrong, physical board games are also great, but this is another way to have a board game experience, and you know, just judge it. That one game that we both played, which is funny. Oops. Hello. Sorry about that.
That's funny. I think that was Sienna Probably because we turned off the intercom, so we don't have to listen to them anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. You should have known better. But we... this thing is fun. So, you know, we just got it. This isn't like an official review or anything, but I thought it was really, really cool, and I wanted to mention it. We'll have links up.
It is cool.
All right, we're out of time.
Oh, so we are. All right, that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening. Feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. I'm jgammett both places. And point your iTunes app right on over to the iTunes store and give us a rating, because we love it when you do that. Makes us feel wanted.
Yes, indeed. And I apologize for not being able to figure out how to use my iPhone and, you know, like, mute it.
Well, see, this just proves that Donald Trump is right.
Yes, exactly. Apple is dumb. And you can follow me on Twitter at TMO Brian. It's Brian with a Y. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom. That's recorded just for us. I'm at geektales.com, and Jeff is at freshbrewedtales.com. Oh, and Jeff has this fantastic post on Smaug over at Jeffarama.
Oh, I guess I better put a link into that too.
Yeah, you better do that. And we'll you know, that's all for this week. That's it.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
And and as always, stay subscribed.
You know, this is our 240th show. At some point, I'll have this stuff down. We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.
I just have to really be careful what I say, because I don't want to build up your hopes only to have them dashed.